Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this Monday edition of the Hagman Report. Peter Barry Chalka was our guest in the last hour, and we got a great next 2 hours lined up for you. It's going to be me and John Robertson and Doc Marquis mainly. And before we get to Doc, I want to bring you a quick word from one of our sponsors. Folks, go to greenovative.com. Greenovative power cells make power anytime, anywhere, in any weather, day or night possible. And there's no better preparations than food and then energy when you're talking about situations that you might find yourself in. Greenovative has an infinite shelf life and will recharge an unlimited number of batteries. They are EMP and eclipse safe and will work when nothing else does. Don't let the lack of preparations chance your survival when you really need portable solar. Again, we had Mr. Yago on a few Fridays ago, and he talked about the importance of battery-operated power when an EMP hits or some other unforeseen circumstance knocks out your power. You can get 12% off charger packages with the discount code Hagman. Get yours at www.greenovative.com. When you need it, you'll be glad you did. Also, the number on the screen, call Alan Riggs at 321-576-2712. Again, greenovative.com. John, I know you got a treat for the audience. I'll call it a treat because it's fantastic what the presentation you did in Chicago. You got a little taste of that today that you're going to bring us in with, and then we're going to bring on Doc.
Yes, exactly. This should be a lot of fun. So just by way of quick introduction, folks, I know many of you are familiar with my background prior to my tenure here at Hagman Report, but for 16 years, I worked in Hollywood in both feature film and television production, and it's particularly exciting this evening to re-engage Doc Marquis, because, Doc, a tip of the hat to you, sir, it was the work, the research, the discernment, the critical thinking applied of gentlemen like Doc Marquis, Paul McGuire, who educated me over the past 6 or 8 years and enabled me to really open my eyes and encouraged me to seek the discernment of the Holy Spirit while in the midst of where I was working every day. And so this evening, what we'd like to do is, for about 10 minutes, I'm going to take you folks through a little story. Some of you may have heard it before, but we're going to go back in time about 100 years, and we're going to talk a little bit about how Hollywood first got its start, how it got its name, and how that ties directly into multi-generational witchcraft going all the way back to the 10th century in what is now modern-day United Kingdom, Britain, Wales, etc. Once I sort of put us in that historic context, and we'll talk about how Hollywood, in fact, got its name, then we'll bring Doc Marquis back in with us and just have a conversation. And we've got the full 2 hours to do this, and we're just excited about it. We're going to talk a little bit about the corporate symbolism that we see in Hollywood and how it relates to ancient occult symbolism. We're going to talk perhaps a bit about the demonic brokerage that goes on in Hollywood. And do people in fact sell their souls for fame? And again, many of you folks have heard previous broadcasts that I've brought to the Hagman Report with similar content. But the beautiful part about tonight, our ambition and our goal, is to bring Doc Marquis' numerous decades of knowledge into the conversation, particularly with the fact that he was born into a multi-generational witchcraft environment. So we're just getting a few IT things set. Tech Eric is jamming around the studio. We're working about 6 different monitors right now so that we can bring to our YouTube live viewers some slides that really depict the era that we're going to be talking about, and also enable our viewers to take a look at some of the symbols that have their roots in ancient occult. Moreover, we're going to take a look at some things that I know are evil and yet really don't have the understanding that Doc does, We're going to talk about, you know, the evil of the Baphomet sign. Why is it an evil sign? We know in the early 1970s that Anton LaVey went on national TV and proclaimed it to be a curse, and did so in kind of almost a darkly humorous way. I say humorous in finger quotes. But we're going to take take an examination of how prevalent and how ubiquitous the Baphomet sign is, what some people think is like the heavy metal rock and roll sign, throughout Hollywood. We're going to talk a little bit about how witchcraft has permeated not only Hollywood with the television and film industry, but also in music as well. And then toward the end of our program tonight, I certainly encourage Doc to, we'll just kind of go free form, and you know, he'll share with all of us his different insights. So again, we've been looking forward to this show for many months. Eric is getting our slideshow presentation up. You know, Doc, while we're waiting for our IT stuff to come together, let's talk a little bit about your book that just came out.
Okay, go right ahead.
Well, by all means, why don't I'm kind of juggling three things right now. Tell folks who are not familiar. Now, you joined us about 6 weeks ago. I think it was July 14th. But for people who are not familiar, just tell folks what your book is about, and I just jump right in, Doc.
Okay, how much time do I have to yabber on?
Oh, I would say take all the time you need.
Well, okay, I was doing a conference for Blocky in the News last year in September. And, Joe, you must remember Colorado Springs Hotel?
Yeah.
Right, you know that long corridor where we were able to set up everything on our tables and such?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Thursday evenings, if you remember, they cordoned that off. So, you know, people like you, people like me, we can set up our tables and, you know, what me not. Well, I was putting up about four or five boxes worth of DVDs on my two tables. And by the time I was done, I had about 400 or 500 DVDs on those tables. I'm just standing there wallowing in self-pity saying, I don't want to do this.
I know that goes, Doc.
Oh, totally. So, well, anyways, while I'm trying to sort through all those DVDs, this very tall, strapping young man, looked like about 25 years old, who shouldn't have been there, walks up to me, and he was just about to say something when he picked up a DVD, and that's when he said, my name is Joshua Dolans. I'm from Charisma Publishers, and we'd like to offer you a book deal. And, of course, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, you know, it was just one of those off, you know, out of left field type things that, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, Doc. And in conferences, you get introduced to all kinds of different people. And you never know what you're going to run into.
Exactly. So I told him that I could talk to him later on, you know, tomorrow, you know, because I was really busy trying to, you know, sort through everything while I could. Well, while I should say, after I had done loading up everything, I pulled out my laptop and decided to look up Charisma House, because quite honestly, I didn't know them from Adam. I really didn't. And when I found out that they were, if they're not the largest Christian publishing firm in America. I mean, these people have over 60,000 distributors. And, you know, they walked up to me and asked me, of all people, would you like to write a book? And I'm going, what? Well, found out that the lady who became my editor, Maureen Aha, and certain other people had been looking at a number of my DVDs, and when they saw my teachings on the rapture, from what I understand, that's what really sold the book to them, and they wanted to make sure that they got this teaching in everyone's hands, because they said, and I'm quoting, they've never seen anything like this before in their entire lives. And here I am thinking, this is just normal, this is how you teach it. And so one thing led to another, and welcome October 3rd, the book, which is titled The Final Rapture, is going to be released.
Wow. And Doc, it's amazing how things like that happen. And, you know, opportunities just fall into your lap. And I believe last time you were on, you told a little bit of the story. Cause I remember you talking about the, you know, putting your DVDs up and the guy coming up to you. But this is, you know, it's fascinating how things work out. So what, a year and a half later, here you are. And here's your book.
Oh, yeah. You know, and God be praised. As I said, in about a month and a half on October 3rd, it's going to be released through Charisma Publishers.
Well, that's great, Doc. And again, yeah. The book is called The Final Rapture, folks. Can they pre-order it?
Yes, as a matter of fact. You can go through Amazon.com or just get a hold of me. I know Prophecy in the News is also taking pre-orders, so you've got a multiple choice there of how you want to do it.
That's awesome. And yeah you sent us a copy. I don't believe it was finished, but it's definitely interesting. And last time you were on, you broke down how the book, how the different chapters of the book and what each section deals with. And you broke it down into three parts very nicely. If you want to give a brief overview of that.
Okay. Well, the book is divided into three major sections, the past, the present, and the future. I don't remember exactly how many chapters there are, but there's quite a number of them. And what we do, before we even examine the book itself, we first have to figure out what makes a rapture a rapture. And that's the biggest problem in Christianity. Now, everyone argues that it's pre, mid, post, or what's that new one called again?
Well, we talked about this. You're talking about the pre-wrath and post-wrath.
Thank you. Yeah. And before we can even figure out which one is right, if you would, we have to first define what makes a rapture a rapture. No one seems to be able to answer that question. And once we do that, then we can go into the past. Into the distant past now, thousands and thousands of years ago, and we'll discover that there have been past raptures. And then we bring it up to the present date, where we take a look at what I call the pre-signs. There are signs in the Bible that were mentioned that, in my humble opinion, people just aren't looking at, and we really need to take a good look at them if we're going to understand, I mean, in all its significance, the time we're living in right now. And then the third section, which deals with the future, we, in a sense, send a letter in a bottle to the future, to those people who are living during the tribulation period, because they're going to literally have hell on earth to contend with. And the whole intention of that third chapter is to witness to those people in the future. And we do this by explaining to them the major prophecies according to the book of Revelation that they themselves are going to be living through. And this way they can see what period of the tribulation period they're in at that point, and then they can just keep following the rest of the major signs as a roadmap so that they know what they can expect. And all along, we'll be witnessing to them at the same times, you know, like, isn't it time to get saved now? And I do mention, I spell it out, you know, the entire sinner's prayer, if you want to call it that, or whatever we're calling it. And I give them plenty of opportunities to get saved. We walk them through the sinner's prayer and everything. And that's what the entire book, if you would, is about. Because my concern is not just for people to get saved now, but what about those folks in the future? They need something also, because nothing says that they're going to come across one of the 144,000 evangelists that are going to be witnessing, nor the two prophets. I mean, they need someone who will send a message to them in the future about salvation.
Right on, Doc. Very well said, and we're going to get back into the discussion of your book in a little bit. And I know you're familiar with what, or you know that we're going to do. John's going to do a little bit of a presentation here, and right. Eric set it up so you should be able to view the presentation slides on your Skype. Is that right?
Well, as a matter of fact, who's that old spot in the picture?
Well, if you're looking in the right area, Doc, that would be you.
Oh, my goodness, I am getting old.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to John here, Doc. And I saw part of this presentation in Chicago earlier this year, and it was fantastic. It's very interesting, very informative.
Oh, great.
Well, Joe, thank you so much. And again, folks, for this hour, as well as all of our third hour, our special guest is great friend of the program, Doc Marquis. And we're so pleased that he was able to join us this evening. What I'd like to do is just take a few moments to place you folks back in a different era. We're going to roll the clock back about 100-120 years, and I'm going to create a context, an atmosphere that will demonstrate that Hollywood is not an entertainment machine that became satanic or devolved into a Luciferian witchcraft agenda, but that, in fact, Hollywood was created out of a multi-generational witchcraft agenda. Now, in order to do so, I want you to put your minds back in the turn of the last century. It's 1910, 1915, New York City, and it's an enormous clash of technology, and it's an enormous clash of culture. And we know that when you see things like the end of the age of steam intersect with the beginning of the age of electricity, when we have the heretofore undreamed of concept of being able to project the human voice over many thousands of miles, as was done by Marconi at the time, when people began to see the very birth of film, they'd never seen anything quite like it before. So our story starts in the turn of last century New York City, and it really starts on the Lower East Side, where there was a contingent of Jewish families who had come over from the old country seeking a better life. But this is a time of very dangerous work environments, and in many cases the father or the paterfamilia of the family would lose his life early from poor food or from work. There were a lot of industrial accidents back then, no compensation for families. And what happened is it often put the younger sons in a disposition where they had to become essentially the men of the house, the head of the household, and keep their mother and sisters going. Now, interestingly, it is through the maternal side of the Jewish tradition that Kabbalah is handed down. And at this time, folks, there were multiple generations living in single domiciles, in fire traps. And so you had often the grandmother and perhaps one of her sisters and the mother training these young, aggressive Lower East Side. They were tough kids, these young Jewish kids, many of whom had lost their fathers. Now, at the time, there were any number of businesses always coming and going, and there were always a lot of storefronts available for rent. And these young entrepreneurial kids figured out, quite possibly, the most technologically innovative thing of its time. And what they did was scraping nickels together. Often they used crime to get the seed money. They began to open up what they called Nickelodeons. Now, folks, these were just storefronts with folding chairs in them and perhaps a sheet, a bed sheet for a screen. But these Nickelodeons, people had never seen anything like it before. Now, I want to pause and mention that even the name Nickelodeon has a Luciferian component to it. They were called Nickelodeons because the price of admission was a nickel. But Odeon is noted as the little g god of the Greek theater, and also the little g god that presides over the drama of the theater, or you could even stretch it to say the drama of deception. So imagine 1905, 1910. You walk into a dark storefront, you sit down, and for the first time in your life, you witness three-dimensional life emanating off a two-dimensional plane. People were so mesmerized by this that they often got up from their seats, exited the Nickelodeon, paid another nickel, and went right back in to watch the productions of the time. These were incredibly popular, and it was probably a lot like when iPhones first came out. And at the time, the films were very simple short pieces. They ran about 6 to 10 minutes, and they were primarily made by the Edison Company across the river in New Jersey. And these young entrepreneurial Jewish kids from the Lower East Side, primarily, they began to franchise out the idea of these Nickelodeons. So they went from owning 1 to 3 to 10, and in some cases, some of them owned 30 and 40, collecting up the nickels of the neighborhood all day long and showing the sepia-toned pieces. Obviously, this is the silent era of just day-to-day life of whatever the Edison Company chose to film. But these kids had a problem, and the problem was monopoly. In this era, you could not get your hands on a projector or a camera, nor could you get your hands on the sound equipment that was being developed again by the Edison Company. Now, this is a few years before the advent of what we call sync sound. And you couldn't get your hands on a single foot of celluloid film unless you were doing business with Thomas Edison, with the Eastman Kodak Company, to a lesser degree, Nikola Tesla, who brought many of the original schematics for the use of electricity that makes even a modern film set today work. These young entrepreneurs, who were not above bending the law, had run up face first against this monopoly. Now, it's important to remember what I suggested earlier, that these young kids, in pursuit of the cash that it would take to not only care for their families in the absence of their fathers, but perhaps even realize the American dream, you know, sort of a Horatio Alger rags to riches type thing. They had been trained in Kabbalah. Now, we're going to ask Doc to speak on Kabbalah here as soon as I'm finished with this opening presentation. But Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, and numerology was something that many of these what would become Hollywood pioneers were well versed in, again, having been handed down through the maternal side of their family. Now, what I want to do, folks, is a smash cut back even further in time to ancient, what would become Britain. Let's call it the 10th century. We're going to take a look at the Druids, and certainly Doc will have a lot to say about this as well. In the northern latitudes of England, 10th century, everything revolved around the rotation and the growth of food. And so many of the significant dates on the occult calendar had something to do with the changing of the seasons vis-a-vis the production of food. And one of the most significant dates was the winter solstice. Now, folks, this was the longest, darkest day of the year. And they note the Toyan tree as the only tree in those northern latitudes of Britain, the British Isles, that stayed green throughout the course of the year. Now, remember that the name of that tree, because this is important, folks. What they would do on the winter solstice is, at places like Stonehenge and many other places typically where ley lines intersect, and again, we've got Doc Marquis with us tonight to explain what he knows about ley lines and about these rituals and rites, they would come together and they would cast spells to bring about a bountiful harvest from Gaia, from their mother earth, from the little g god Gaia. Now, an important part of these rituals and rites, an important part of the actual casting of the spell, was the use of a wand. Now, we tend to trivialize wands as kind of a Harry Potter type thing, or, you know, an accessory out of a Halloween costume or something like that. But wands were a very important part of casting the spell, of what we've heard our brother Russ Dizdar call dirtying the air. And the wands were typically made from the wood of the Toyin tree. You see, they marked this tree as a symbol that brought the people and the harvest from the longest, darkest day of winter and capitulate on the winter solstice over to the first day of spring, the bringing forth of new life from the earth. And as they would do these rituals and rites, they would use wands made of the Toyin tree. Now, I want to go back to early Hollywood. So, Southern California, 1910, was just a dusty basin with great Spanish influence, and it was primarily agriculture, a lot of citrus. It really was not a populated area. And what these young, tough Jewish kids, their pockets bulging with money from the Nickelodeon ventures, they decided the only way to break free of the Edison and Eastman Kodak monopoly was to jump on a train and journey 6 days across the entire continental United States to Southern California.
Still takes 3 days today in a car.
Well, some of these people included, for example, Adolf Zucker, who went on to form famous players Lasky Studios. Max Sennett would be another one, who was the creator of all the Keystone Cop comedies. And when these young, tough, entrepreneurial Lower East Side kids, plenty of money to spend, when they arrived in Southern California, they knew that not only did they have technology and a brand new invention at their disposal, but they knew that they had the most hypnotic, the most ingenious power to manipulate the mind and to condition the consciousness of the population. And they brought it to a relatively unknown backwater of the country at the time. In fact, they knew through their Kabbalistic teachings that much like the ancient Druids in their worship of Gaia, they held figuratively in their hand the greatest wand, the greatest capability to cast a spell in the entire history of humanity up to that time. Now, I want to mention, to wrap the story up, that the Toyin tree in England is also the American holly tree. So as these Kabbalistic young entrepreneurs began to set up the studio system in L.A., they knew that they were about to wave the most powerful and perhaps most poisonous wand, again, in the history of humanity. They knew that what they had was ultimately Hollywood. And that's where the name comes from. It is the holly tree, the wood of the holly tree, the wand that has deceived multiple generations since the inception of the town. Doc, I'm going to hand it over to you. I know I did a very cursory walk through history, but perhaps we could pick up with the Druids and talk a little bit about the Toyin tree and places like Stonehenge.
Okay. Well, if we go back even further than what you had, John, we'd have to go back to the 900 BC, where these nomadic tribal people known as the Celts made their way into ancient Brittany. And, of course, nowadays, modern-day Britain. They would inhabit the areas known as England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. And, literally speaking, this was a very barbaric, nomadic type of people. And like any other culture, they had a religious system. And this particular system was run by, as you pointed out, the ancient Druids. Now, the name Druid itself comes from the Gaelic, which means the men of oak. Because these people, in their system of witchcraft, which is still used by the Illuminati to this very day, Druids mean, literally speaking, the men of oak. the oak tree was a sacred, the most sacred of all of their trees in existence. I mean, it was long-lived. It was as sturdy as a rock, which is why they chose that particular tree. Now, we go back to the Toyin tree, as you pointed out. Yes, that is the holly tree. And to this very day, holly is one of the three of the most sacred plants in the order of the Illuminati. And it is a very dangerous plant at that. I mean, the only thing I could think of off the top of my head that's probably more poisonous would be, the mistletoe. Mistletoe, my goodness, you just take three of those berries, you could kill someone with them if you knew what you were doing. But anyway, so this was a very sacred plant to them. I mean, the only difference nowadays is instead of making the wand out of the Toyin tree, modern day practice dictates you make your wand out of the birch tree. So when we're looking at the Hollywood aspect of this, my goodness, I mean, folks, it's the Hollywood is right there in, you know, the title, you know, the usage of the old holly tree to make your wand out of. I mean, this is so obvious. I don't see how anyone could really miss it. Oh, I like that photo you just put up. Interesting choice, John. But
thank you.
Those inverted pentagrams should be pointing up. That's the only thing I'll say on that.
And folks, we're gonna touch on symbolism with our special guest, Doc Marquis, this evening. And Doc, this is exactly what I was hoping that we could do tonight. Is, you know, I've had the experience in Hollywood. I've seen things firsthand. But when we bring on a guest such as yourself, and really you stand alone in the repertoire of Hagman guests, because you have that specific direct experience having come from a multi-generational witchcraft family. Now, if I may, Doc, before we can get back to Hollywood in a second, but we've picked up so many new listeners and viewers just in the last 12 months. We've been so blessed with our numbers. Would you mind just letting the new people know a little bit about who you are and where you come from, and that way they'll be better enriched by the rest of our story?
Okay, well, I'm not surprised that Doug and Joe have such an addition over the last year with their listening audience, because you know, John, I have done more than 1,000 radio shows in this life, and I can tell you categorically without fear of contradiction, the Hagman and Hagman Report has always been my absolute favorite radio show to do, and as I'd like to refer to Doug and Joe as, the dynamic duo of the radio airwaves.
Well, that's very nice, Doc. Thank you.
You know, you still owe me a cup of coffee.
I'm just going to Amazon one to you.
Just don't think because I'm being nice to you, I forgot. But for my background, folks, let's make this short and brief. I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. I was raised in an Illuminati family. In other words, I was a practicing what's known as a Luciferian witch. In the order of the Illuminati, you don't worship Satan, you worship Lucifer. And there is a big difference if you understand your occult theology here. Well, anyways, so I went through the Illuminati ranks like anyone else, except I had a major advantage. And that included over most of the leadership, because you see, my family history at the time when I was practicing, I was a seventh generation Illuminati witch. My family roots go back into this all the way back to 1789. And I know more names, dates, places, times, events. I've got the dirt on just about anyone you could possibly come up with that's involved in the Illuminati. And so, long and short of it, I was in the Illuminati for, I think it was 20 some odd years, and eventually what had happened, when I was in the military, a born again Christian had invited me to, one of the churches, you know, for church service, and I'm not gonna say exactly what I said back then, but let's just say the answer was no. The long and short of it is, for the next 3 years, no matter where I went, and I mean no matter how far I went, there were some born-again Christians just waiting in the rafters to witness to me. Well, finally, at the end of those 3 years, I understood what the Christians were saying in light of what I had been doing all along. So it was on April 15th, 1979, I will never forget that date. I walked into a Christian church, and I admit it, I was a sold-out slave of Satan. But God be praised, on that same day, I left as a born-again child of the King. And for almost 40 years now, I have been fighting against the order of the Illuminati, exposing their plans for a new world order, the corruption in the governments throughout the world that's involved in the Illuminati, you name it. That's what I've been doing. And as you can see at the screen right now, we have the front page of God's Ministry. It's called It's a God Things Production. And this is what God has had me to do. I mean, I'm running one of his ministries as one of his overseers. And, yeah, we got a new book also coming out. There it is. But basically, that's the long and short of it.
Well, Doc, thank you so much. And, you know, one of the things, one of the key elements that you taught me, of course, we weren't acquainted at the time, but this goes back to late 2012. And this, folks, was really a baseline start point in my journey that ultimately ended in my being removed from a stage at Universal Security, having I'd begun doing shows on the Hagman Report and other platforms about much of what Doc Marquis and I are going to cover. But Doc, one of the things that I took away from probably the first time I ever heard you speak was that, and I hope you can touch on this a bit, the Luciferians counterfeit. They counterfeit. They take scripture and they take what is doctrinally proper and they 180 it, correct?
Oh yes. Anything in just about any of the major occult religions will be based on either a direct reversal of something you'll find in the Bible or a perversion. And one quick example. In the scripture, it teaches us to, I believe it's Romans 8:1, it tells us to present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Now notice, it says to present our bodies a living sacrifice. In their cult, they kill you as, obviously, a dead sacrifice to their false god known as Lucifer. And that's basically how you're going to see things in the occult. It'll be either a direct reversal or a perversion of something you'll find in the scriptures.
And they're very good at that perversion, Doc.
Oh, very good. You know, these photos that I'm looking at right now are some of the ancient depictions of Moloch.
Yep.
Moloch, you know that part of the scripture where it teaches us never to allow our sons or daughters to pass through the fire?
Yeah.
It's mentioned quite a number of times in the Bible. And you'll find one such place that was located in the Valley of Hinnom that is right outside of the gates of Jerusalem. If you just cross that little open parcel of land and go down, you'll go into the Valley of Hinnom, where they used to sacrifice their children by making them walk into a fire pit, or, as you can see in this photo here, they would take their newborn babies, put them on the hands of that idol that was called Moloch. Now, those hands usually were over a huge fire pit, so those hands were glowing red hot. And in this depiction, I noticed Moloch had two horns. Sometimes Moloch had one horn coming out of the center. Now, they would do this. Believe it or not, it was a quid pro quo religion. You give something to the god, they give something back. And in this case, Moloch would bless you, financially speaking, if you offered up a child to sacrifice. Now, you know that little spiraling gold horn or silver horn, sometimes it's red, that Italian people will wear?
Oh, yeah.
That's known as the Italian horn. Some call it the unicorn's horn. Some call it the leprechaun's wand. And if you ask an Italian why they wear it, they say, well, we're wearing it because we're going to receive a financial blessing. That horn comes directly from the horn of Moloch.
Doc, let me jump in quickly. I was able to pull up some scripture during your commentary, and this is a very serious direction, instruction from God. Now, I'm looking at Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 35, and it says, quote, "And they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire unto Moloch, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin." Doc, I'm going to lay one more on the folks. This from Leviticus. Let me grab... Okay, and it says... okay, "And thou shalt not let any of the..." I'm sorry, this is Leviticus chapter 18, verse 21. "And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Moloch, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord." Pretty serious instructions, Doc.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to back it up to verse 10 in Deuteronomy chapter 18, because it says, "There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire." This was way back, you know, before Jeremiah was around. This is one of the earliest warnings we were given about this practice unto this false god known as Moloch. But as the point is, as it says, symbolically speaking, it's still going on today, because that horn that is being worn by Italians and other people is still the same horn of Moloch. And notice the blessing is exactly as the parents expected back then. They are expecting a financial blessing to this very day.
Excellent point, Doc. Let's go back to Hollywood for a moment. I want to ask your impression. Now, years ago, when Harry Potter first became really, you know, a big popular franchise, I heard the conservative Christian remnant body, if you will, come down pretty hard on the films. Now, I was a backslider at the time, Doc, and I thought that they were being perhaps a little heavy-handed. The image we have up right now is from one of the Harry Potter films, and we see, of course, the punctuating of a spell with the wand. Doc, can you just talk a little bit about how gently Hollywood conditions the young minds of our children, starting with things that I think many people in the church, if they're being honest with themselves, take their kids to see the Harry Potter films. What do you think?
Well, as a matter of fact, let me tell you a story. This one lady, born again Christian, walked up to me and asked me if I thought it would be okay if children went to see this Harry Potter craze. I looked at her in the face and I says, "Does Harry Potter have witchcraft and any other part of the occult in it?" She goes, "Yes." I'm going to, "Well, there's your answer right there." And I found out next day, she took the kids anyways. I think all she wanted was my validation to say, "It's okay, go ahead and do it." No, I'm not about to do that. In this photo I'm looking at, that's Hermione Granger holding her wand, casting a spell, there's no doubt of it. You'll find out throughout the entire Harry Potter series, beginning with the first one, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. I think here in America it's called the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah, I believe it's the Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah. In England, it's called the Philosopher's Stone. The reason it was properly referred to the Philosopher's Stone, there's an ancient belief that a true alchemist could make what was known as the Philosopher's Stone. And through that, there was three things you could do. One of them was transmute lead into gold. The second one was to create what's known as a golem. A golem, you will find, is a creature in Jewish mysticism that you usually made out of clay. It would be a big, tall figure if you did it right. And through the Philosopher's Stone, you could breathe life into the creature. And the third thing, you can make from it would be known as the elixir of life. By drinking this elixir, you could prolong death from ever approaching to you. You could live literally forever if you kept making enough of the potion. Now, in the Harry Potter series, you'll find out that there was a particular alchemist slash wizard known as Nicholas Flamel. And he made was one of the few people who actually made the elixir of life through the Philosopher's Stone. And this was revealed in the first movie, as I recall, Nicholas Flamel was 665 years old, and he would be celebrating his next birthday as 666. Coincidental or not? I don't know. But I find it very interesting that he would be celebrating his 666th birthday. And in the storyline, it's also believed that Albus Dumbledore, the headmaster of the Wizarding School, he himself had also partaken of the Potion of Life. Now, as far as the whole of the Harry Potter theme goes, well, the very first three movies were made with the kids in mind. The reason is because the kids would really want to go see these things, and mom and dad have the money to take them. And as far as from the children aspect goes, oh yeah, these were very, very well written, very engaged movies and such. And so the children, they would beg their parents to take them. Now, it wasn't until the fourth book in this eight-book series that things began to take a dark turn. And that's, you know, when you find out about, you know, the real rise of Lord Voldemort, what had happened in the first war against them, and everything. I mean, it really, really gets dark. And the movies themselves wouldn't be anything without the books. And what was really interesting about these books is that, of course, books of this size and nature and expense usually are bought by adults. So you're bringing in a lot of cash now from the adult world. We're talking about, you know, let's face it, Harry Potter through the books and the movies alone, and we're not even counting the merchandise now, is a billion-dollar industry. They've even got, you know, the Harry Potter theme park over at University Studios now in Florida.
Indeed.
This is how big a phenomenon just one aspect of the occult world has become. And quite honestly, I have been expecting things like this to happen. We find out in Revelation 18:23b, excuse me. The prophecy tells us, for by thy sorceries will all nations deceived. Now, it doesn't say part of the nations or some of the nations. It said all nations of the world are going to be deceived through the occult, and it's all going to be handed over to the Antichrist. Now, in order for that future prophecy to be fulfilled, you and I and Joe and Doug must see these are resurgence in the ancient occult practices greater now in all of recorded human history. We are seeing the cause of that prophecy. We see the cause. That prophecy will be fulfilled. This is why that prophecy is there, and this is why the whole of the world is going to be primed and readied for all the ancient occult religions so that it can be handed over to the Antichrist, because at that point it will be one occult religious system. And that's what we're looking at right now. This resurgence of the ancient occult religions greater now than all of recorded human history.
That's fascinating.
You know, Doc, we've got a nice segue. We've got a few minutes until we go out to break. Let's segue off of Harry Potter. In our last few minutes of this hour, can you explain to us a little bit about the symbol that we're seeing, that the folks joining us on YouTube Live are seeing, this Baphomet sign, if you will? Because when we come back from break, I'm going to demonstrate how prevalent this sign is, even in Disney animation cells. But perhaps, Doc, you could explain where this comes from. Why is it evil? What's the deal?
Well, when we look at that statue of the goat, that's not the Baphomet. That's the mezzanine goat.
Okay.
No, yeah, it's made up of, notice his right hand on your left-hand side is pointing up, and the other one is pointing down. And my goodness, there's another old goat on the screen right now. Anyways, mezzanine goat, or what's also known as a hermaphroditic goat, is made up of both the male and female sexes. One arm points up, pointing towards the spirit world. The other hand points down towards the physical universe, which shows, you know, symbolically speaking, the old occult axiom, as above, so below. In other words, nothing starts on the earth physically happen, you know, physically speaking, unless it started in the spirit world first. Now notice, in between the two horns, which you find on the original brazen statues of Moloch, there is the light. There is a torch there. It is the torch or the light of illumination. And this was originally drawn by Eliphas Levi in the 18th century, who was a 32nd or 33rd degree Mason. And don't be surprised, it was a Mason who did this, folks, because it was back in 1786 at the famous Congress at Willenbad, Germany, that representatives from the 23 Supreme Masonic Councils of the World at the time, they met with Baron Adolf von Koenig, who was the right-hand man of Dr. Adam Weishaupt, who started and created the Order of the Illuminati. They met with Koenig for 30 different sessions. And after the conclusion of those 30 different sessions, those Masonic leaders signed a blood contract vowing to follow the Illuminati's seven-part plan towards the creation of the Novus Ordo Seclorum, or the New World Order. That's where you get this from.
Okay. And it's amazing, the and we've known this throughout the history of the occult and scripture, the amount of symbolism that's used, especially in the occult. This is one of the main ways that they communicate. And but, you know, before even the written word, or maybe not the written word, it's as old as basically as time itself or humans' existence on this earth.
Right. It goes all the way back to Babylon itself, the Tower of Babylon, Nimrod on the plains of Shinar, all that. Oh, yeah. This is the old stuff. This is the ancient of ancient. It doesn't get older than this.
And that's why, you know, we see with all these secret societies, and you know, you see certain numbers that appear frequently all the time, you know, like 11, 33, 32. It's the same thing with the symbolic nature of symbols, or the nature of symbols, where they're one of the oldest forms of communication. And unless you're initiated, as they say, you won't even know that it's a method of communication or what it means, unless you're,
right,
you know, a member of the club.
Exactly. Even in the Masonic writing, it teaches us that, those people who first entered into Masonry, they're shown a series of symbols. They believe that this is the true meaning of the symbol, but they don't realize that there's depths and different meanings to the same symbol. And you only learn that the higher you get into Masonry, or, if you would, also in the Illuminati.
Okay. And, John, do you have something to say?
Oh no, I'm just listening. I'm fascinated. But Doc, thank you for taking us back to, and that's what we want to do tonight, folks, is give you some context going all the way back to 1786. Adam Weishaupt is a name that you will hear often. We'll pick this up on the other side. I'm going to hand it back to Joe. But, you know, interestingly, we talk about the counterfeit. We talk about the 180, the flipping of Scripture and all that is holy. Adam Weishaupt actually began his life, if I'm not mistaken, Doc, in the priesthood.
Yes, he was a Jesuit priest, and he held the chair of the professorship of Jewish canon law at the University of Ingolstadt in Bavaria, Germany.
Yeah. Folks, we're talking with Doc Marquis. It's a God Thing Productions, 777.com. He's going to be with us through the next hour. Just want to use this time to give people a quick reminder of some of the other things going on here in the Hagman Studios. Check out our daily show, The Doug Hagman Show, which is on 9 to 10 Eastern on Global Star Channel 3 and on Blog Talk Radio. And you can listen to the archive on Blog Talk Radio or get the podcast from iTunes or any podcast applications, as well as the Hagman Daily Show with John and myself, 2 to 3 p.m. each weekday. And we are, what, we just launched our fifth week today, and it's been really fun. It's, we're getting into a lot of diverse topics, at least on our show, the Hagman Daily Show. And I know my father's been doing a real good job with investigative reporting, and there's tons of information you can find in his show, especially today. Peter Chalka wanted me to mention to all people to listen to the Doug Hagman Show from today, that it's chock full of important information. Our guest is Doc Marquis. He will be with us through the next hour, taking us to the end of the show. Don't go anywhere on this Monday, August 21st, 2017. We will be right back after these messages.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood, Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.